Port Arthur, The Dissenting Narrative, Podcast Part 2. In this talk, I'm going to continue reviewing the case for Martin Bryant not being the Port Arthur shooter. As with the first part, to reduce the size of the podcast, I will be omitting references. However, these, including all details of witness statements, can be found in the transcript. We resume the narrative at the Port Arthur historic site Tollbooth, where the gunman has just killed four people who arrived there in a gold-coloured BMW. There is even more to be told about the Tollbooth shootings. There is firm evidence to suggest that very shortly after death, these four deceased people were searched and stripped of any incriminating material. The following is from a gunsmith's notebook on Port Arthur by Stuart Beattie, 6th edition, May 2006, Southwood Press, pages 207 to 215. Bingara, Bolt from the Blue. When two colleagues, Mrs. Wendy Skerr and Andrew McGregor, visited Inverell in March 2001, as guests who both addressed the audience at the Inverell Forum on that Friday evening of the 23rd, a female, Miss Julie Butler, who operates grazing interests near Bingara, had a friend rise to her feet during question time and ask a question that hit like a bolt from the blue. It was claimed her friend had information delivered to her by her local police, which proved beyond a shadow of a doubt that the official account of events that day were fallacious. Later, Miss Butler related to me her extraordinary experiences regarding this time segment of the massacre as it related to her friend, Jim Pollard. Beattie continues. On Sunday, 28th of April 1996, Julie Butler had arranged for local Bingara police to travel out to the property and meet with her to clear up a totally unrelated stock matter. At the pre-arranged time of 2 p.m, Julie and her mother sat in their vehicle waiting at the agreed rendezvous, but the police did not arrive. Our rural people are very patient and understanding, and so the pair sat quietly chatting and listening to the car radio. 2 hours later, and as the familiar theme began heralding the 4 o'clock radio news, Julie alighted from the vehicle to greet the local Bingara cop she knew quite well. Now, the Butler property is 23.5 miles, or a 40-minute drive over gravel roads, away from Bingara in northern New South Wales. With the handshakes and an apology for his delayed arrival done with, and before Julie had time to begin with the formal matters at hand, her uniformed policeman friend, in serious tones, told her that she should listen carefully to what he was about to say. Continuing, he explained that before leaving Bingara Police Station, his superior had instructed him in words to the effect, quote, "Don't breathe a word of what we have just learned to Miss Butler at your meeting today," end of quote. Obviously, the policeman had agonised over his superior's instructions as he drove the 40 minutes over the dusty gravel road to the Butler property. After all, back in 1996, there were a few country cops left that believed, as members of the constabulary, they enjoyed the trust and good friendship of the people in their community, built on by them fulfilling their obligations to them. So, choosing his words carefully, the Bingara policeman told Julie to make sure she watched the evening TV news services, as there had been, quote, "a serious incident at Port Arthur in Tasmania that would affect her directly," end of quote. Clearly, the local cop had reached a compromise position that appeased both parties. Julie Butler's thoughts leapt instantly to the only person she knew who was definitely at that time holidaying in Tasmania, Russell James Pollard, her very dear and long-time good friend. Beattie continues, After having discussed the matters at length with Miss Butler on several occasions, and considering all information very carefully, I believe the facts speak for themselves. Bingara police were aware of Miss Butler's friendship with Jim Pollard, so it then becomes obvious that via police communications and sometime between 1450 hours and 1520 hours, or at least some 40 plus minutes before 1600 hours, Bingara police at the Bingara police station had learned very shortly after Russell James Pollard had been shot in a shooting incident at Port Arthur in Tasmania that he was deceased. It was at 1600 hours, 4 p.m, that documents confirmed the arrival through the toll booth of the first Tasmania police officer, Constable Peter Hessman, to the historic site. But he had no opportunity to establish a preliminary identification of Mr. Pollard, as he didn't break his journey there at the toll booth. The local Bingara policeman's subsequent reaction to the information received would seem to suggest the Tasmanian informant also curiously exhibited a primary desire to confirm the nature and/or extent of the friendship that existed between the deceased and his local friend, Miss Butler. Beatty continues, "Police cannot notify next of kin, or friends for that matter, of any death before the deceased is legally declared dead by a medical practitioner. So here we have a situation whereby someone had opportunity and reason to establish the identity of Jim Pollard lying there on Jetty Road near the toll booth and pass the information to police at Bingara by way of an inquiry rather than a notification meant for the deceased next of kin. A prominent notation in Jim Pollard's address book had to be the key which initiated this action. But the question remains, quote, as Pollard's next of kin had no association with Bingara, was that action triggered by a pressing need by some unidentified person to confirm the identity of persons noted prominently in Jim Pollard's notebook? End of quote. Interestingly, none of Jim Pollard's immediate family, including his son Philip, his brother Keith, twin sister, or his wife Dawn, from whom he was separated, have ever received any of Jim Pollard's personal effects, which included a valuable gold wristwatch, his wallet, and importantly, his address book. Beatty continues, the police training video clearly shows Mr. Pollard's body furthest from the camera on the western shoulder of Jetty Road, wearing dark sports slacks and a white shirt. His upper body is hidden from the camera, so I cannot say if he is wearing his gold watch or not. It is also interesting that Russell James Pollard was one of the last victims to be formally identified when his son Philip flew to Hobart from the mainland. But I can also state he was the first deceased victim to have interstate friends know of his death. Recently it was claimed his next of kin had never received a death certificate, a claim at time of writing I'm unable to confirm. Nevertheless, what became of Mr. Pollard's valueless, but to the family sentimentally priceless, address book? What happened to Mr. Pollard's wallet and personal papers? What happened to Mr. Pollard's valuable gold wristwatch? Why have the family not received his personal effects? Who identified Jim Pollard as deceased and so made the call to Bingara police? Has a death certificate for Mr. Pollard been issued, and who signed it? Beatty continues, my inquiries always come back to the same question, quote, who among those we know of on the historic site at the time had opportunity and reason to remove all of the personal effects, the personal items, from the deceased Jim Pollard, and using information contained in his address book to then make inquiries of police in Bingara that alerted a friend that he had been involved in a fatal incident at Port Arthur, end of quote. I shall now try to address this question, says Beatty. Let us look at the information we have assessed, which deals with the toll booth incident in relation to the movements affecting the original occupants of the BMW. The first witness to mention a gold BMW on Jetty Road was Deborah Buckley. Deborah and her husband Thomas, quote, at about 1:45 p.m., end of quote, had passed through the toll booth in their red Commodore Holden Avis rental car and began the descent on Jetty Road that led to the Broad Arrow Cafe car park. The couple noticed, quote, a large group of people, end of quote, jogging across the grassy area about 100 metres away, when a male beyond a gold-coloured BMW in front of them yelled out to them something like, quote, don't go down there, there's someone with a gun, end of quote. Thomas immediately began reversing their car back up Jetty Road and then turned about, probably at the Church Road intersection, driving back up towards the toll booth. Deborah Buckley tells us that the, quote, gold-coloured BMW, which was or had been directly ahead, was also reversing and turning to head back in the same direction, end of quote. So the, quote, gold-coloured BMW, end of quote, in question, had also gone through the toll booth down Jetty Road, then reversed and turned around to retrace its journey to the toll booth and park in the incoming or wrong lane, so providing a clear run for any vehicle leaving the site. Beattie continues, Thomas Buckley went to Aileen Kingston in the toll booth to be told she was aware of the shooting and that the police had been called. Deborah Buckley also tells us she then had a short exchange with a male in the gold BMW who had dark complexion, quote, perhaps of Greek extraction, end of quote, she says. This was Robert Saltzman, and she conveyed to him the seriousness of the situation. She then turned and saw the gunman down Jetty Road who was in the process of killing Mrs. Mikak and her two daughters. At that point, Deborah and Thomas Buckley abandoned their Commodore and left the area on foot. So they leave our story. The BMW was stationary, parked wrongly in the incoming lane, just beyond the pedestrian crossing at the northern extent of the toll booth traffic divide, so blocking all traffic attempting to enter the historic site via the toll booth's left-hand lane, but at the same time giving an unobstructed exit to the gunman about to depart the historic site. From this point in time, there is a few moments gap in witnesses' statements from when the gunman regained the Volvo on Jetty Road and drove the 60 or so metres up to where he stopped, still facing north in the outbound or correct lane directly opposite the parked gold BMW. Consequently, we are unaware of the movements of, or if any, of the four occupants of the BMW sedan in those next crucial moments. However, the continuity of the story is taken up by the three occupants of a red Ford Corsair as they arrive to enter the site by the toll booth. Deborah Rabe, at the time, worked at St. John's Ambulance Headquarters in Hobart. On that Sunday, Deborah, with her two-year-old niece, Ashley Rabe, a work colleague from Adelaide, Frida Chiok, and her, that's Frida's son, Nicholas, were all enjoying a day trip to the area from their home in Hobart. Deborah was at the wheel when they pulled up about a car's length from a gold-coloured BMW parked in the wrong lane and blocking their entry path. They tell us that a well-presented gentleman wearing glasses, quote, in his 60s, end of quote, was seated in the driver's seat of the gold BMW. This was Jim Pollard. Beside Pollard was seated a female who was waving Deborah to, quote, go back. This was Mary Rose, Rosemary, to her friends, Nixon. Beattie continues. Nicholas Chiok was seated in the front passenger seat beside Deborah with his mother Frida Chiok in the rear seat behind him. Nicholas's attention was focused on a yellow Volvo which had a surfboard on a roof rack he saw parked facing north in the northbound or outgoing lane directly opposite the gold-coloured BMW and therefore, in his estimation, quote, about two sedan car lengths away, end of quote, from Deborah Rabe's car. That's the car he was in. The witness goes on to tell us A person with long hair was at the wheel of this, quote, oldest style car, end of quote, a yellow Volvo, and a, quote, short-haired female in her 50s, end of quote, was seated beside the driver. This we know now to be Helene Salzman. With the BMW's female passenger, Rosemary Nixon, still remaining seated in the front passenger seat and continuing to wave them back, Nicholas states that he then saw a man alight from the rear compartment of the driver's side of the yellow Volvo sedan. He was probably in his mid-60s and of average height. And that's the quote, probably in his mid-60s and of average height, end of quote. This male was Robert Salzman, who remained standing beside the Volvo while the driver, a male with long blonde hair, alighted. Nicholas Chiok continues by telling us that from the body language of these two males, he could tell that they were arguing. He further states that the gunman, that's the blonde-haired male, turned to look towards the people in the BMW. Then, as he walked around the front and down the left side of the yellow Volvo to its rear, he, that's the witness, quote, distinctly remembers he, the blonde-haired male, looked directly at the witnesses in the red Ford Corsair, end of quote. Before the Volvo obstructed his, that's the witness, the witness's view as to what the male was now doing. Importantly, though, Nicholas did not see the boot lid raised up, and therefore I can confidently state the blonde-haired male went into the passenger side rear compartment, not the boot, as Nicholas had an unobstructed view if the boot lid of the Volvo had been raised. Beatty continues, the blonde-haired male then walked back around the rear of the Volvo carrying two long arms, one on a sling over his shoulder, and returned to again argue with the male still standing beside the Volvo. Now, this last point becomes quite critical in arriving at a sound conclusion to this segment, for if these witnesses' accounts are correct, and I see no reason to doubt these three corroborative statements, clearly the two passengers must have entered the Volvo without duress or force of arms. Even more importantly, Robert Salzman had been seated on the same bench seat beside the two long arms. In light of Deborah Buckley informing the occupants of the gold BMW of the shootings and the volley of shots that confirmed her story just 60 metres away down Jetty Road, one must then ponder these three questions. And these are Beatty's three questions. 1. Why did Robert and Helene Salzman enter the gunman's Volvo? How was the gunman able to feel so comfortable as to allow Salzman to sit behind him and beside two rifles he'd just used to murder 15 people minutes earlier? And 3. Why didn't Robert Salzman remove the firearms as he alighted and really intervene in the massacre? Beatty says the answer to these questions seems so very obvious. We are then told, he says, that as little as 10 seconds passed at this point before the blonde-haired male raised the gun to in line with Robert Salzman's chest with the muzzle very close to his body and fired, and the man fell to the ground and did not move. I can positively state the police training video shows the body of Robert Salzman lying stretched out on his back face up and parallel to the driver's side and close to the yellow Volvo, which is parked right over the pedestrian crossing at the northern extent of the Tollbooth Divide, facing north, his head to the northern extent of the white lines in the pedestrian crossing. Beatty says that the position shown in the police training video tape is entirely consistent with Nicholas Chiok's statement. Beatty continues, at this point, Pollard alighted from the driver's seat of the BMW, walking around the front of the BMW, and approached this armed male who'd just shot and killed his old army buddy, Robert Salzman, standing beside the Volvo. Upon reaching the gunman, Pollard was said to utter but a few words to him before the gunman again raised the rifle, a 30-caliber firearm, and with the muzzle again close to his chest and the gunman looking back towards the occupants of the red Ford Corsair, he shot Jim Pollard dead. Contrary to what has been published in the Daily Telegraph, attributed to his son Philip, on the 22nd of April 2006, at page 61, and the citation for the bravery awarded to Robert Salzman, the claims for both Salzman and Pollard attempting to disarm the gunman near the toll booth cannot be sustained when all the witness statements are considered. Beattie continues, returning now to the witnesses' accounts of the incident, we find that while Deborah Rabe, quote, casually put her car into reverse, end of quote, Nicholas watched the gunman walk around the front of the Volvo for the second time, open the front passenger door and stand behind the open door. He then reached into the car for the female, Helene Salzman, and after the red Ford Corsair had moved no more than, quote, two car lengths, end of quote, the woman was dragged to her feet and shot beside the rear passenger side door of the Volvo, which accounts for the bullet damage only ever referred to by the DPP indifferently. With Deborah Rabe's attention now solely focused on removing the vehicle from her boxed-in position in the queue, as another car had stopped behind them, the gunman was still under observation by his passengers. Frieda Chiok tells us that as Deborah reversed into a space on the eastern side of the road and looking to her left, she saw the blonde-haired male gunman trying to drag Helene Salzman, who he'd already shot as she was crouched down on the ground, around and across the road in front of the Volvo at its driver's side front corner. Rosemary Nixon still remained seated in the front of the gold BMW as Deborah drove away fast from the scene. At this point, another witness arrives on the scene, Graham Sutherland. His wife Stephanie and two sons were in a V6 Maroon Magna sedan. As they approached the toll booth, Mr. Sutherland stated he saw the tan-coloured BMW still parked facing him and the Volvo still parked in the outgoing lane, both slightly in front of the toll booth facing towards him. Sutherland goes on to state, quote, to the driver's side I saw a body laying on the roadway, lying on the roadway it should be, I think face down, end of quote. This had to be Rosemary Nixon. He also stated of the BMW, quote, the driver's side door was open, end of quote, and continuing he states, quote, the body was completely out of the vehicle, the feet of the body were close to the driver's door and the head was pointed on a 45-degree angle down towards the historic site. I think there may have been a white top on this person with fawn trousers, end of quote. Now, when the above accounts are compared with the court transcript, it becomes obvious there are some problems here. As a consequence to this investigator, says Beattie, the positions of the bodies of Jim Pollard, Helene Salzman and Mary Rose Nixon, as shown in the police training video and the account as provided in the court transcript, are not entirely consistent with that which is indicated by witness statements. Beattie continues, during this video clip captured on Monday 29th, the camera does not pan. It just looks west, across and at right angles to the carriageway, with the three cadavers spread out across the sealed surface. The body of Jim Pollard seems to be partly off the sealed surface, feet towards the camera and head obscured, wearing dark shoes, dark slacks and a white shirt. I believe the position of this body strongly suggests it may have been moved at some time between when the victim was shot and the video was captured, as the position is inconsistent with that established by several of the eyewitness statements. Beattie continues, when the inexplicable actions of Robert and Helene Salzman are considered, and indeed the actions of their companion, Jim Pollard, I'm forced to abandon my earlier held belief that Jim Pollard was innocently caught up in a covert action on the part of his hosts. It seems yet again the body count of covert agents has risen considerably. Is it now probable that 4 or possibly even 6 covert agents died by gunshot while on the job there that day? This, I might add, has been an unexpected development for this author. Now, that is the end of that long quote from Stuart Beattie's book, A Gunsmith's Notebook on Port Arthur. There is plenty of speculation among investigators as to how and by whom the shooting was planned and financed. Some suggest that because the original target might have been the US retirees, there was involvement by those wanting traction on gun control in that country. This is an astonishing assertion to anyone who is not engaged with the evidence. Researchers have come to the belief that there were elements within the Tasmania Police, the Tasmanian Government, Victoria Police, New South Wales Police, and federal authorities who were in the know to various degrees after the fact and some before, and who all engaged in the cover-up and framing of Martin Bryant. As already mentioned, there was no SLR used at the Port Arthur Historic Site. The damaged SLR found in the ruins of Seascape was a throwdown weapon, as indeed was the damaged AR-15 also found there. The damaged AR-15 had had its breech blown open. A Tasmania Police ballistics expert, Gerard Dutton, is reported to have concluded the rifle action was blown up by a faulty round that Martin Bryant was just unlucky enough to have purchased. This hot factory round explanation for the damage to the AR-15 is clearly false, however. Ammunition manufacturers claim such a situation to be so highly improbable as to be described as virtually impossible. Modern rifle ammunition is manufactured in huge batches. Powder burn rate is carefully matched to case capacity for optimal performance, meaning that factory loads are usually filled to about 95% capacity, leaving only 5% available for accidental overload. The potential is for perhaps a 5,000 to 10,000 pounds per square inch overpressure spike, which may cause a primer cup failure or an expanded primer pocket or a difficult case extraction due to case head expansion, but modern rifle actions are proof to much more than that. The AR-15 M16 platform is one of the most widely produced, most tried and tested modern rifle actions ever made. The 5.56 NATO cartridge generates about 50,000 pounds per square inch peak pressure in a rifle that can handle more than twice that without giving way. To explode any modern rifle action requires a massive overload with faster burning powder like pistol powder, which in turn requires expert knowledge, as well as access to reloading equipment and materials. Moreover, if such a failure were to occur while the rifle were in use, the shooter would probably be seriously, if not fatally, injured. This narrative therefore asserts that the damaged AR-15 was made unusable prior to being planted in the Seascape ruins after the fire. Both rifles were damaged in order to prevent ballistic comparison with spent projectiles recovered from the Port Arthur Historic Site. The rifle was found inside the fire zone, but according to investigator Stuart Beattie, had only superficial damage to its plastic parts and nylon webbing sling. Beattie argues that given the public record time frame, it had to be a Tasmania police person who put the AR-15 there. He argues that no one else had opportunity to do so. Whether this is true or not, the extent of the damage to the AR-15 is another undeniable black swan for the prosecution's case against Martin Bryant. Bryant's car was left at the Port Arthur Historic Site toll booth. The blue sports bag containing the bloodied knife was left in the cafe. The shooter took the black bag with him as he left the cafe and placed this bag in the boot of Bryant's Volvo, not necessarily the Volvo he had arrived in, by the way. The fact that there were two bags, these being the outer, larger black bag and the smaller blue sports bag similar to the one Bryant owned, is clear proof that the shooter was following a prearranged procedure to set Bryant up for the shootings. Bryant's passport was also supposedly found in his car, as was his shotgun and the two SLR magazines. New South Wales policeman Justin Mark Noble, who just happened to be on the site at the time of the shootings and whose highly suspect actions immediately afterwards have suggested to several researchers that he was implicated, claimed to have discovered these things. Bryant's video camera, which had to disappear shortly afterwards because the shooter had handled it without gloves, was left on the cafe table alongside the blue bag. The remains of the shooter's meal and his drinking cup also disappeared for obvious reasons. The neglect and destruction of potentially viable forensic evidence was far too systematic and complete to be accidental. The only witness at Port Arthur who knew Martin Bryant and who had actually known him from childhood, Jim Laycock, said the shooter was not him. At least three other people who eyeballed the shooter at close range said they believed the shooter was not Bryant. At Seascape, the two local police arrived and parked on the road outside but were soon being shot at. While one shot hit the road near a car, most went over their heads, apparently not trying to hit them, and they may or may not have known that. Their actions earlier in the day, when they were supposedly sent on that wild goose chase to the other side of the peninsula, are somewhat fishy in terms of the time frame and completely uncorroborated. They may have possibly been responsible for getting Bryant to Seascape, but that is more likely to have been the work of Tiger. The BMW was well alight when they arrived. A Tasmania Police Special Operations Group officer, Andrew Mark Fogarty, was there to tell them about wounded people from the road shootings at the Fox and Hounds up the road. One of them went to assist. The question is, of course, what was Fogarty doing there so soon? Some researchers have expressed the belief that he had just thrown an incendiary device into the back of the BMW, but there is no hard evidence for this assertion. They also believe that Pears, the hostage, was still locked in the boot when the car caught fire. It has never been officially admitted where Pears' body was found. The official narrative said he was handcuffed to furniture in the house. These handcuffs have never been produced, by the way. Bryant said he never owned any, and it seems they are completely fictional. Because Fogarty was on the scene so inexplicably early, it has been suggested that he may have been responsible for getting Bryant to Seascape, but again, there is no hard evidence for this. Furthermore, it is also claimed by these researchers that in the morning, Fogarty would set fire to the house after the shooters had melted away into the darkness, leaving a drugged Bryant to die in the fire. There is evidence to suggest the fire started in the top story of the building, and an incendiary device could easily have been fired in through an open window, but there is no hard evidence to support Fogarty's involvement other than his very difficult to explain early arrival at the scene. There is, however, a report from a journalist of a police officer telling them the next day that the police had indeed set fire to the house to end the siege. Before the main Special Operations Group force arrived, minus their top man, Mick Dyson, who was conspicuously absent throughout the whole operation, but whom dissenting researchers believe was actually inside Seascape during the siege, again, there is no hard evidence to support this, two of the police saw a dark-haired woman. Now, only one of these policemen identified the person as female, but they saw this person being chased around the yard, and another heard high-pitched screaming coming from the back of the cottage. One of the policemen asked for permission to shoot the assailant. Permission was apparently twice denied. presumably by Fogarty, but again there is no hard evidence it was actually him, except for the circumstantial fact that he would have been the most senior officer present at that time. Over the police radio, other people listening in, hearing the words, "Don't shoot, this is the way it has to happen." End of quote. After the fire, Sally Martin's body was found in the ruins. The official narrative says she was shot, but the evidence is that she died from multiple blows to the back of her head. She had grey hair, but in the late afternoon light of the 28th, it may have appeared dark. She was the only victim, apart from Pears and Bryant, who was not shot, although bullet fragments in her body were apparently mentioned in the autopsy report. The house was eventually surrounded by 400 local and interstate police, who were of the firm opinion that there were multiple shooters in the house. Indeed, there were. 3 kilometres down the road, the Port Arthur historic site was left unsecured by police until about 7:30 p.m. when 3 shots were fired from behind the toll booth by one of the agents to signal the all clear and to further alarm the people there. While the survivors at the historic site huddled in terror at the sound of these 3 shots, the police were finishing a barbecue about 500 metres from Seascape. When armed police did eventually arrive at the historic site to secure it, it was a full 6 hours after the shooting had begun. Absolutely inexplicable and unforgivable. Someone in Seascape both initiated and answered many phone calls up to about 9 p.m. with the Victoria Police negotiator Terry McCarthy, and even though it is thought it may have sometimes been Bryant speaking, by no means a proven fact, it is unlikely it was him who initiated the calls. Officially, these transcripts, many of the original recordings went missing, were all of Bryant talking to the negotiator. However, the conversations clearly indicate the person or persons calling themselves, quote, Jamie, end of quote, displayed at times a good knowledge of Special Operations Group weaponry, particularly night scopes. The tenor of these exchanges is often not indicative of a low IQ, inexperienced person like Bryant. McCarthy expressed the opinion that Bryant, if it was indeed Bryant, quote, seemed as if he was acting a role, end of quote. Also, while Bryant was apparently talking, shots could be heard in the background. And these shots were transcribed as coughs, but digital analysis of the surviving recordings show them to be gun reports. During the early morning, the gunman and his controller melted away into the darkness, probably extracted by boat. Seascape backing onto Long Bay, and the siege not covering the area behind the house. At 8:35 a.m., Bryant emerged from the blazing building with third-degree burns to his left side and back. He had been lying on his face in a drugged stupor, and the pain of being burnt had awoken him. There were no burns to his face or any other part of his body. He is reported to have come out and gone back in trying to remove furniture from the building. He said incomprehensible things as he was arrested, such as wanting to know if his girlfriend, Petra Wilmot, was safe. When he was first visited by Petra in jail, the conversation was monitored by a prison officer who said that Bryant's first question to Petra was about his house. He wanted to know if it had burnt down. This narrative asserts that the house was intentionally set on fire by the police. At that stage, they were not to know the hostages were dead, but they obviously did. Even after Bryant was arrested, the house was allowed to burn to the ground, despite the fact the fire brigade was in attendance. The burning of both the car and the house was blatantly a means of eliminating evidence. It was suggested that the possibility of exploding ammunition made fighting the fire too hazardous, but this is a furphy. Uncontained cartridges outside a rifle chamber do not explode with much force and have been assessed as relatively harmless in quite a few firefighting publications. Bryant's own house was broken into the night of the siege before the morning of his arrest, and his photo, in the case of the Australian newspaper, digitally enhanced with demonic eyes, the original taken from his home, was on the front page of Tuesday morning's newspapers on the streets all over the country, including illegally in the Hobart Mercury. There were another two raids on his home over the next few days, and only on the final raid were found stashes of guns and ammunition, which is no surprise. His assets were taken from him by a special act of Tasmanian Parliament long before he was convicted, precluding any privately funded defence. Petra Wilmot had been with Martin for 4 days preceding the incident. She said she had not seen any change in Martin's behaviour. She had never seen any firearms or ammunition or handcuffs at his house, and neither had his mother. Bryant freely admitted to having kept his guns in his car. Petra and Martin had done things together and were going to do things together. The affair was going well. She described him as a decent, kind person. It is difficult to assign any motive to Bryant for the shootings, although the Tasmania Police, the Tasmanian DPP and other Tasmanian government officials tried their best to do so. Furthermore, there has never been an inquest into the deaths of those 35 people. John Howard echoed Jack Ruby, the murderer of JFK Patsy Lee Harvey Oswald, when he said he wanted to save the people of Tasmania from the pain of an inquest, and even though it was not strictly his call, an inquest was the last thing the Tasmanian government wanted either. Just the issue of the faulty gift shop door was enough of a disincentive there. Bryant was tried and found guilty by media long before he supposedly confessed. The police released hugely contrived, erroneous and damning statements about him, including one about an arsenal of weaponry in his car that day and also at the house. A press statement said 43 weapons were transported by Bryant to Seascape and found in the ruins, when in fact the remains of about 6 guns were found, only one of which, a Chinese-manufactured SKS 7.62 by 39mm carbine, would have been plausibly usable before the fire. The others were missing parts, and some had been kept by the Martins as decorative pieces. The SKS belonged to neither the Martins nor Bryant. The outraged national public lapped it up and demanded retribution. Bryant spent at least 3, possibly up to 5 months in solitary confinement, was subject to psychiatric intervention, and had 3 dodgy police-appointed lawyers before finally changing his plea to guilty. This, of course, had to happen. There could never have been a successful prosecution. Basically, there has never been any objectively sustainable forensic evidence against him. Prior to changing his plea, however, the Tasmanian Director of Public Prosecutions and the Tasmania Police went to great lengths to build a case against Bryant. Witnesses whose evidence was in any way exculpatory were written to and advised they would not be needed in court. Those who were thought to be useful were asked to identify Bryant's photograph months after the exact same photograph had been stolen from his house on the night of the shootings. Months after the photograph had been published across the nation, including Tasmania, and after months of having their memories compromised by intense media coverage centred on this photograph, the only colour photograph on the whole police photo board, in fact, Bryant was never identified face to face in any police lineup. This dissenting narrative is based on eyewitness accounts, the public record, the police timeline, the audio-visual records, and a great deal of inductive common sense. The official narrative is supported by nothing apart from Bryant's so-called confession and some very bizarre statements at an interview after more than 2 months in solitary. If there is one simple fact that demonstrates the contrived inadequacy of the police response to this terrible event, it is that no attempt was ever made to close the Eagle Hawk Neck Bridge and thereby quarantine the entire Tasman Peninsula to all road traffic to and from. Bryant did not actually confess to anything. He simply changed his plea. However, it should never be forgotten that Bryant was a ward of the state. At no time while in custody was his guardian present. Therefore, Bryant's guilty plea is not legally valid. Remember that Bryant protested his innocence for many months in the face of unrelenting duress from the state while in solitary confinement. His police-appointed lawyers did not defend him. They were working for the other side, and they put him under extreme pressure to change his plea. Just how extreme this pressure was is demonstrated by this extract from his mother, Carlene Bryant's book, My Story, published in 2010. Quote, "On one occasion, Avery," now she's referring to John Avery, the third and last of Martin Bryant's police-appointed lawyers, "who was later struck off and jailed himself for misappropriation of client funds, Avery offered to take me to visit Martin. After arriving at the prison, we were taken to Martin's cell. I soon discovered why I was there. On his previous visits, Avery had been unsuccessful in persuading Martin to plead guilty. He thought that if I could encourage Martin to change his plea, perhaps something could be done for him. The general sentiment at the time was that since the perpetrator had been apprehended, it would help ease the suffering of the survivors if they did not have to experience the pain of a public criminal trial. The media followed this sentiment with their reporting, and I was under great emotional pressure to convince Martin to plead guilty. It was believed that a trial would cause undue suffering to those who had already suffered enough. To this day, I am ashamed to say that I told Martin that he would never see Lindy," that's his sister, "or me again unless he pleaded guilty." End of quote. Summary of arguments. 1. The circumstantial precursors, these being the mortuary van, the embalming box, the journalist's conference, the medical conference, the Port Arthur Historic Site senior staff taken off-site, the National Firearms Agreement ready to go, and the American retirees tour. 2. Bryant was positively identified at Fawcett at a time that would make it impossible for him to have killed David Martin before 11 a.m. 3. Sally Martin was not shot, she was bashed to death. 4. Lana said he met Bryant at 1:05 p.m. and spoke with him for several minutes. This makes it impossible for Bryant to have been with the two women with their broken down van at that time, and highly unlikely he could have made it to the toll booth by 1:15 p.m. 5. Bryant had no mechanical expertise and was never known to do drugs. Even if he had wanted the marijuana, it is unlikely he would have had a $50 note. 6. Both a shotgun and a 7.62mm were used in the cafe. The shotgun wound was positively identified by an experienced paramedic, and there were 7.62mm spent cases on the cafe floor. 7. 12 witnesses described the gunman's shoulder-length hair, and 7 saw below shoulder-length hair. No one described the hair as wavy. 8. The blue sports bag was not long enough to carry an SLR or an AR-15 rifle. However, the prosecution attempted to get around this by claiming the shooter used a collapsible stock AR-15 SP-1 carbine found in the seascape ruins, but witnesses drew a rifle with a non-collapsible stock. 9. The damaged SLR found in the ruins had a G serial number indicating European manufacture. The two magazines supposedly found in Bryant's car had imperial specifications. 10. The shooter used his weapons right-handedly. 11. There was another yellow Volvo positively identified within the Port Arthur Historic Site at the time of the shootings. It was driven by two women who behaved suspectly. 12. The manner in which the gunman acquired the gold BMW completely destroys the lone nut with a gun scenario put forward by the prosecution. Clearly, the gunman had accomplices. 3 corroborative witness statements indicate the Salzmans were involved with the gunman. They knew him, were not afraid of him, negotiated with him and had easy opportunity to totally disarm him, but didn't. In fact, all four occupants of the BMW were somehow involved. This is undeniably a black swan demolition of the prosecution case against Martin Bryant. It cannot possibly be argued differently. 13. The Bingara story adds credence to the above point. Russell, Jim, Pollard was officially involved in the conspiracy. The only person who had known Martin Bryant and who had known him from childhood, Jim Laycock, quote, did not recognise the male as Martin Bryant, end of quote. At least three other people said they didn't think the shooter was Bryant. Many people described the shooter as someone in his late teens or early 20s. Bryant was 28 at the time. He had a smooth complexion. The shooter was described as having a noticeably marred complexion, as if he had had acne or the like at some stage. 15. There appears to be no defensible explanation for Special Operations Group Officer Fogarty being the first Tasmania police person at Seascape. 16. It still hasn't been admitted where Glenn Pears' body was found. 17. The DPP was unable to produce the handcuffs. It is unlikely they would have been burnt. Smith & Wesson cuffs are of high-quality steel manufacture. 18. Police were of the opinion that there were multiple shooters in the cafe. Analysis of sound recordings indicate gunshots while Bryant was supposedly speaking with McCarthy. 19. Police were denied permission to shoot at the person chasing the woman. Who was this woman if it wasn't Sally Martin? 20. It took 6 hours for armed police to arrive at the Port Arthur historic site. Only after 3 all-clear shots were fired did they arrive. 21. Bryant had third-degree burns to his back and one side. This is not indicative of injury to a person who was conscious and who started the fire. 22. The hot factory round explanation for the damage to the AR-15 is clearly false. There is no other explanation for the damaged AR-15 other than after-the-fact planting of evidence, and as such it is an undeniable black swan for the prosecution case against Martin Bryant. 23. Bryant was only ever identified months after the shootings from a photograph that had been published across Australia, including Tasmania. 24. The Tasmania police did not attempt to close the bridge connecting the peninsula to the mainland, something so very logical to do, and something that could have been so very easily done. 25. There has never been an inquest into the deaths of 35 people and the wounding of a further 20. 26. Petra Wilmot described Bryant as a decent, kind person. She had been with him for 4 months and the affair was going well. It was a good time in Bryant's life. He had never been known to express any animosity towards anyone, except apparently a neighbour's wayward cat. To conclude, despite the political platitudes, it is truly amazing that there has never been an inquest into the murder of 35 people and the wounding of a further 20 at and near the Port Arthur historic site on Sunday, 28th of April 1996. Yet even so, there is hard evidence to support the view that the conviction of Martin Bryant as the Port Arthur gunman was a gross and willful miscarriage of justice. Furthermore, at the time, Bryant was a ward of the state, having been assessed as psychologically incapable of managing his own affairs. Yet his guardian, the public trustee, was never present at any of the proceedings leading to his incarceration. And this fact alone appears to make the manner of his conviction illegal. It appears that every official effort was made to ignore, neglect, discard or destroy potentially viable forensic evidence during and after the Port Arthur massacre. The official narrative therefore relies on a questionable photographic identification process conducted some months after the event, and Brian's own words spoken after months in solitary confinement without genuine defence counsel, and most probably after being subject to psychiatric intervention. This dissenting narrative has its weaknesses. However, it objectively complies with the evidentiary record, as incomplete as that record is, and the conclusions reached appear both logical and plausible. Two arguments in particular completely undermine the official narrative, these being the toll booth shootings and the damaged AR-15 rifle found in the seascape ruins. To disbelieve the gunman had accomplices, you need to disbelieve three corroborative witness statements, not to mention audio analysis of shooting while Jamie was on the phone with Victoria Police negotiator Terry McCarthy. To disbelieve evidence was planted at Seascape to incriminate Bryant, you are likewise required to put fantasy before fact. In the light of these two arguments alone, it is impossible to imagine Bryant ever having been convicted if he had been given a fair trial with competent representation. At a conference of the Australian Society of Archivists conducted in Perth, Western Australia, 25th to 28th September 2018, Tasmanian archivist Nikki Ottavi claimed a 75-year embargo had been placed on the release of official Tasmania police records relating to the Port Arthur massacre. She further claimed that the eventual release of such information would be at the sole discretion of just one person, the Tasmania Police Commissioner, whoever he or she might happen to be at that future time. Why are the Tasmania Police so afraid of this information being released to the public if they have nothing to hide? It is a misconception to believe such a conspiracy could not remain a secret. Obviously it has. Planning would have been informal and unrecorded, on a need-to-know basis, with just a few fully in the know and those making most arrangements uninformed as to true purpose. With at least five insiders shot dead, the fear of God would have been put into the lesser players, and an ends justifies means ideology has led to even ordinary people saying, well, at least we got rid of assault rifles. Even supposing there were whistleblowers, who would believe them? There is already sufficient evidence in the public domain to disprove the official narrative, but few people are listening. Why Australians prefer not to listen is actually an interesting question. Is it a psychological need to believe in the system, or simply a matter of not wanting to appear foolish? Perhaps an embedded fear of guns paralyses people's critical faculties, or is it because in this buy it, don't build it, throw it away, don't fix it, digitized, service-oriented, consumerist society, people have insufficient practical intelligence to interpret hard evidence? More probably, it is a complete lack of curiosity and/or concern resulting from a preoccupation with more personal pursuits such as career and financial betterment, personal appearance, recreational activities, boys and girls, toys, television, social media, etc. The most significant factor, however, has to be unwavering mass media support for the official narrative. Even the supposedly erudite presenters at Radio National, ABC, exude an intellectual smugness to the point of totally ignoring concerned listeners' inquiries. In Australia today, seeing black swans without cultural approval is entirely unacceptable and only leads to one being labelled a conspiracy theorist, the universally pejorative epithet for people who legitimately question any official story.